on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the story of Purple Heart recipient Dick Reiber, 93 years old. He served with the 82nd Airborne during World War II. For the past 23 years, he's lived in Kingsburg, California, but he was born in Georgia and spent time all over the country as a young man as his father chased down work during the Great Depression. We've already heard about how he met his wife of 72 years now, Lois, while roller skating in Wisconsin, and all the twists and turns his military story had to take in order for him to meet his bride. They got married shortly before Dick headed overseas. And you had never, ever been on a ship before. But here you are, May 1944. You're headed across the Atlantic Ocean. That must have been quite an adventure for you.
It was. But oddly enough, being May, we never saw any kind of rough weather to speak of.
So you didn't get seasick?
No. Nearest I got seasick was later coming home.
So you get to England May of 44?
Yeah. We went into the Scotland, into the Scottish port, and they shipped us down to Midland, England, down to near a town of Leicester. You spell that L-E-I-C-E-S-T-E-R.
Yeah. Looks Leicester. Like Leicester, but it's Leicester. Yeah.
Where I was for a few months, since I spent that month of August, I guess it was, with that sore on my tailbone, a big cyst that erupted, they put me in the base maintenance group. So I didn't go into combat when they made that fall drop into around the Meijin.
Well, and before that, they made a jump into France on June 6th. Do you remember hearing about that? You're there in England?
I heard about it, but yeah. I was not part of the group.
Right, but was that a big deal to you to hear about this invasion and the gigantic force that was headed across the channel? Or didn't make that big of an impression?
Well, I thought that they were making some progress to get the situation under control. Mm-hmm. We were getting trainees in from various places into this group near Leicester, England. Mm-hmm. That were going to be part of the rebuilding the glider regiments.
Glider regiments had gone over in the D-Day operation, and then in the fall of 44, Operation Market Garden up in Holland, there were more gliders that went in there. You would have gone if not for the tailbone situation. You had a cyst on your tailbone.
If I had been rated physical,
yeah,
but they were still had some pretty tender scar tissue.
So that operation didn't turn out too well. It was pretty disastrous. There were a lot of Americans and a lot of glider infantry that were killed up there in the Netherlands. So maybe that cyst on your tailbone saved your life?
It might have.
Yeah.
Because when I did get hit later in combat, there was an aid man there that got me under control and headed back in the chain of command.
Right. And we're going to get to that. I want to ask you a lot about that. So these two operations happen. You're not involved in any of those. You're still in England, and you're after you get out of the hospital, you're on this base maintenance crew. So you guys are just...
Well, we weren't doing much there. Yeah. They were bringing in some more trainees, but then they took the whole group and wiped that camp completely, as far as I can remember, and flew us over to France to an old army base. Old French army base, and we were assigned to rebuild the base as we could because the Germans had been there and they hadn't left it very nice.
So this is in Reims, France, and it was German-held territory that the Americans had captured, and now we're looking to build an operation out of there.
They were looking to build up a base,
yep,
for a unit to get it back in combat shape to go further. I remember standing on top of the old A-frame ladder that was something nailed together, mm-hmm, repairing light bulbs up in the ceiling of the place. Because I was willing to handle light bulbs, they'd assign me the job of fixing the electrical.
So you can answer that age-old question of how many soldiers does it take to change a light bulb?
I wasn't changing light bulbs. Actually, I was putting sockets in where the Jerry's had ripped the light sockets out.
Oh, okay. So you were doing all the wiring.
I was rewiring light bulbs, sockets.
All right.
The night that we learned about the Battle of the Bulge beginning, mm-hmm, I was sitting in with a group of four or five other people playing a nickel poker game. and I had just gotten a big hand.
Uh-huh.
And they told us to get busy and pack our bags, that we had to be ready to move out by midnight.
So you didn't get to play your big hand.
So I never collected. Best poker hand I ever had, and I never collected.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, they loaded us on some trucks, and we traveled for a day and a night, I think, to get up to the north side of the Battle of the Bulge. I was 101st. Airborne had already moved into the south side there.
So you're with the 82nd Airborne now.
Company C, 82nd Airborne.
So you're arriving in Belgium.
So they got us up there somewhere they thought that was near where they wanted us. This way, they unloaded us, and we got out and started walking. So.
And what did you see?
Countryside.
Did you see soldiers coming out as you were going in?
I never got close enough to see a German soldier.
No?
What I did see was Christmas Day. We were a little town somewhere in Belgium.
Uh-huh.
And somebody started shooting machine guns at us from the woods up a long hill.
This is Christmas Day, 1944.
I think it was Christmas Day. We had the ground around there was frozen about 6 inches, four to six inches deep.
Yeah.
At that time, I had been transferred to carry ammunition for a 60-millimeter mortar. We heard this Jerry machine gunner up there, and we could hear the bullets going overhead. And the lead gunner for that mortar says, "Hold it a minute, I'm going to re-aim this." And I don't think he could see anything, but entirely by sound, I believe, he reset the aiming of it. You know, they lean it back and forth to aim it.
Yeah.
And then they take, on the tail end of it, there's charges, different charges. And they can take and leave most of them on if they want the project to go a long way.
Right.
Or they take most of them off if they just want to get it just barely in front of their people out in front of them. He reset the mortar, reset the charge on a shell. He dropped two shells down the barrel of that thing. You take it and drop it down. When it hits the bottom, it's like a shotgun shell in the bottom.
Right.
It hits a firing pin and it goes off. And he dropped two, waited a couple minutes. We never heard any more from that gunner.
Mm-hmm. So even blind to where that position
that
was.
That guy was a miracle. I mean, he was just had a touch for it.
That is impressive.
And I never did learn his name.
So that there's another situation where if he doesn't miraculously pull that off, you guys might have been sitting ducks for that German machine gun?
Yes.
You mentioned how frozen the ground was. Had you ever dealt with cold like what you encountered there?
Not really. I had dealt with some cold up in South Dakota.
Right.
It gets cold up there.
But I bet you had better sleeping arrangements in South Dakota than at the Battle of the Bulge.
Quite a bit better.
Where'd you have to sleep at the Bulge?
In my foxhole.
How'd you dig a foxhole?
You went out and dug it for yourself.
Even through the ice?
It so happened that the few times I did dig a foxhole, we were back in the woods a little bit, back in brush, mm-hmm. and the ground doesn't freeze as hard back there.
All right.
And in fact, it was a few days later, we'd taken a good march for quite a few hours at night, and we'd gotten into this other area and dug in. And about that time, I saw this happen. And one of our armored groups came through this little town over there, following the road. They couldn't make any progress if they got off the road because of the ground being frozen partway, and they just enough so that they'd sink in and couldn't get out of it.
The tanks would get stuck.
They'd get stuck.
All right.
They got out just out by the edge of town, and a Jerry gunner, somebody over there, spotted them. He zeroed in. He'd already zeroed in on that area. Mm-hmm. So he knew just how to shoot his gun. And he knocked out the lead vehicle. Then he knocked out the last one that he could see in that line. And then he could pick the rest of them off to shoot himself. That was Hogan's Task Force 400. I don't think I'll ever forget that.
So you...
I saw that.
You were watching this, and it's just devastation. It's just sitting ducks.
Well, not like I would be a field around here, away from it. We were in the edge of a grove of small trees.
So just, we're talking 100, 200 yards, something like that.
It might have been a quarter of a mile.
Quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
But you're watching this, and there's nothing you can do about it.
No.
And Americans are getting killed left and right.
And we couldn't tell where the gunner was that was doing the shooting at them.
Mm-hmm.
But those 88s that they had were really a nasty piece of artillery.
How did you handle that? What did that do to you to see that?
I wasn't really getting a close-up, so it didn't penetrate quite as much as if I'd been closer. But just seeing those vehicles get shot, I couldn't tell whether there were people in them. By the time the first one got hit, well, they would have evacuated the vehicles. They'd gotten out of them because I knew they couldn't get away. And I never did hear how they did make out as a group, except that they had gotten pretty well shot up.
That can't make you feel too encouraged about your own future or prospects of getting out of there alive.
Well, funny thing, but I guess I just didn't have the emotional setup right that I would worry about it so much.
Maybe that's a good thing.
It either happened or it wouldn't happen. As I said, the next night we got to move to a different area, going out of a little village there. In fact, that's where I saw my first Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah?
In that little village. And there was a hill there. We climbed that hill. I was carrying machine gun ammunition for a 30-caliber light machine gun, and then.
All right.
And I got down in the snow and didn't get far enough down in the snow. I don't know whether if I'd had my face clear down in it, whether or not I'd been that shell fragment would have missed me completely or not. I don't think so.
Before we get more into that, let me take you back to Christmas Day. And I know you just said you didn't have the emotional makeup to think, oh, I might not make it and worry about all that. But on Christmas Day, when you're out there freezing your rear end off and the enemy's shooting at you, I imagine there had to be a moment where you thought, boy, it'd be nice to be back home in the States with my wife.
Yes.
And something tells me there's probably been a Christmas or two in the 70 years since that you've thought back to that Christmas.
There's been a few.
What do you think of when you think back to that Christmas?
I think that my life has been watched over.
Did you feel it then? When you were out there in combat, did you feel that God was looking out for you?
I felt that it probably. It was beyond my worry, beyond my capability to do anything about personally at that moment. And for some reason or another, that worry just didn't get hold of me, and it didn't.
So now we're into January. It hasn't gotten any warmer. There's still snow everywhere and ice, and you're sleeping out in it. And on the 4th of January, as you said, you're carrying this machine gun ammunition.
Boxes, metal boxes with a belt of machine gun ammunition.
And had you guys been under fire before you got hit, or you didn't know this was coming?
We had moved several times. We went through this little village. They had us lined up along down below it, and then we were supposed to go up there because they thought somebody was up there to shoot at, I guess. The one I was near, they all spread out. I mean, we weren't one every 50 feet around there.
Uh-huh.
And my machine gunner was up ahead of me, and I figured, well, in spite of that few Jerry shells going overhead. I saw two of them.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of that, if he didn't move out of there pretty quick, it'd be because he couldn't, and it'd be my turn to go play with the gun. Only thing was that Jerry was firing every 30 seconds. And the next one had my address on it. So here I was up on top of this hill.
Right.
A lot of bush over that to that side of me, valley down in front of me. More open land in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was pretty bad hit when afterward.
So you went to get down. You got to his position where his machine gun was.
No, I never saw him.
You were heading his way.
I was backing him up, waiting to see if he to get him some more ammunition.
Right.
He was supposed to call another box of ammunition.
Because if you took too long, that may cost him his life. If there's too long of a pause between his firing, he becomes more vulnerable.
He does.
So you're waiting to get him this ammunition. They start shooting at you. You tried to get down?
What they were doing, there was no small arms fire there. They were throwing shells over.
88.
Artillery shells over.
Uh-huh.
And they were going way over us.
Right.
Where I was. Unfortunately, they dropped one a lot closer.
So they're making the adjustment, and this 88 shell comes right in your area.
They can drop those right in front of the gun itself if they want to.
And in this case, they landed one right next to the guy trying to bring ammunition to the machine gunner. We have to catch our final break. But, you know, in some ways, it's pretty amazing that you're actually hearing from Mr. Reiber today. Not only the fact that he survived, but that he can talk and you can understand him after what the fragments of that German 88 shell did to his jaw 70 years ago. We'll hear it from the man who survived it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.